This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Margot Adler was part of several defining political events of the 1960s, including the Civil Rights Movement, the Berkeley Free Speech Movement, and the Women's Movement. She's been dissatisfied with most of what she's read about the period. She says most of the writings are by men of a certain fame, usually heavy on sex and drugs. In the 60s, Adler was too self-conscious about her body to spend much time with sexual adventures, too scared to take LSD. Now she's written a 60s memoir called Heretic's Heart. Adler is NPR's New York bureau chief. Her previous book, Drawing Down the Moon, was about women's spirituality and witchcraft. Margot Adler's grandfather, Alfred Adler, was one of Freud's most famous collaborators. Her parents were both leftists. At college in Berkeley, Margot became part of the New Left. I asked if she thought she was carrying on her parents' politics or breaking with them.
Well, I would say that in the beginning, I felt I was very much in the same tradition as my parents, that I was not really rebelling. And in fact, when I was arrested in the free speech movement, while I was worried what my mother was going to think on a personal level, it really was true that when I finally called her up from jail, she quoted that famous statement from Thoreau, which is, you know, Thoreau is in jail and Emerson comes to visit him, I think. And Emerson says, you know, to Thoreau, what are you doing in there? And Thoreau says, what are you doing out there? And she actually quoted that, you know, that statement to me on the phone when I called from the middle of jail. So in the beginning, I would say that I really did see myself as desperately wanting to not only follow in their footsteps, but even do more, to be a cadre.
And by cadre, you mean what, like a radical foot soldier in a larger movement?
Exactly, exactly.
In writing about the Berkeley Free Speech Movement, you say, unlike some of the men, for instance, in the Free Speech Movement, for whom the movement was also connected to being adored by women and having sex with women who adored them because they were powerful in the movement, that it wasn't about those things for you.
Well, I think it was always about ideas and friendships. It was not, I was a virgin. I mean, I have to say this very, very plainly. I was a virgin during the free speech movement. And at the end of the free speech movement, I was still a virgin. And I was very much not at home with my body. I think I used my weight as armor, as a way. I even made myself as ugly as possible so I would be taken seriously, intellectually. And so I didn't do a lot of things that I think a lot of other women did in the movement. I didn't staff an office. I didn't. A lot of the women who staffed those offices were making coffee. They were running the Mimeo machines and all those kinds of things. And I was very much on the outside. I went to demonstrations. I, was a follower, but a very cautious one.
You know, you write a lot about how self-conscious you were about your body and how you were really not a part of or very little a part of the sexual experimentation of the period. And I have a feeling a lot of readers will really identify with that. I think there were a lot of people who were a lot more self-conscious than they were willing to let on at the time.
Yes, and I think that, it's a funny thing.
Not self-conscious and uncomfortable, I should say. Yes, go ahead.
I have to say that I did do some sexual experimentation, and it's in the book. And as a matter of fact, there have already been some pre-reviews who said that some people will be upset by my candor. But I think that sex was very scary to me. And I'd actually like to read a paragraph that I think in some ways is the most... this is an odd thing to say about a book that's very, very radical. It's in some ways the most radically conservative statement in the book, and in some ways the most radical statement in the book. And it's about sexuality. And I've come to really understand that most people, we were too young to do any of that stuff well. Most people get good at that stuff later on. And I think that one of the lies that is still perpetrated generation to generation, and it's still something that college students all over the United States are essentially given this lie, that they're supposed to be good at all this stuff immediately. And so I'm going to read this one paragraph, which is, "But accepting my body was one thing. Dealing with sex and sexuality was another. I didn't understand that most people are not naturally good at sex, and that for many people, ease and joy and sexuality doesn't come until after they are 30. Most people get better at sex with time. Some people live perfectly fascinating lives and never get very good at it. And dare I say it, Some people find a great idea, a fascinating conversation, a deep comradeship, or even an extraordinary meal just as satisfying. Music can raise the soul and body to heights of energy and delight. Community action and protest can make the skin tingle and the juices rise. And what of religious ecstasy and the altered states produced by ritual? There is very little place in our culture to talk about forms of transcendence other than two bodies rubbing against each other.
Is that something you were comfortable saying at the time?
Oh, I think at the time I was very confused about a lot of that stuff. I think I thought that to say that would make me seem totally weird, totally abnormal. I think it took the 70s, it took the women's movement, it took consciousness raising, it took Cher Height's, book, it took a lot of things to make me feel that it was okay to say that sex was not the be-all and end-all of a life.
My guest is NPR's New York Bureau Chief Margot Adler. She's written a new memoir about the 60s called Heretic's Heart. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Margot Adler. Part of your new memoir, Heretic's Heart, is given over to a correspondence that you had with a soldier, an American soldier, who was in Vietnam while you were active in the anti-war movement. And you reprint his letters to you and your letters to him. Obviously, you've kept those letters over the years. Had you not read them for a long time before putting them together for the book?
Well, actually, I had not read them for a number of years. Then I had obsessively gotten involved in this correspondence through fluke, and I should say that I met this American soldier through the mail. I found a letter he had written to a Berkeley newspaper and was just so overwhelmed and moved by that letter that I wrote him and he wrote me, and we started this incredible correspondence, which in retrospect seems sort of like the real way we were, you know? I mean, sort of dark ethnic Berkeley demonstrator meets, you know, Midwestern WASP soldier, and, you know, the two of them reveal their lives to each other and try to make each side seem more human to the other. And so I kept these letters, not sure, actually I forgot about them for a number of years, and then I saw the movie Coming Home and went and sort of dug them out and remembered that they were there.
This soldier had written a letter that was published, and that's your response to that letter is what started the correspondence. You started writing him in response to it. What did that initial letter that was published in the magazine say?
The initial letter, which was published in the Berkeley Student newspaper on April 23rd, 1967, said, "I've heard rumors that there are people back in the world who don't believe this war should be. I'm not positive this, though, because it seems to me that if enough of them told the right people in the right way, then something might be done about it, or someone might consider doing something about it, or someone might consider thinking about doing something about it. At least they wouldn't continue living perfectly assured that everyone agrees with their little ways of ethnocentric thinking, right? I've been waiting for you to organize. I guess that'll be a long wait. But in the meantime, would you please march faster? You see, while you're discussing it amongst each other, being beat, getting in bed with dark-haired artists, substituting Mao for LSD, which proves he's a dope, deciding who should really run the school and all the myriad other equally important stuff. Some people here are dying for lighting a cigarette at night or because the NCO in charge was drunk. I haven't understood that other reason yet, you know, the one in the songs. Some of them are ugly, though, and some are fat. There have been fellows die who used to scrape barnacles off barges. So, what can I say about a guy who's lying in the mud and stuff, with his cytoplasm and cellulose torn and running out of small circles in his head? He'd rather be eating hot buttered popcorn down on one of Chicago's beaches, probably. You've got the right idea anyway." So that was the letter. And I read that letter and I was overwhelmed. I just kept on reading it over and over and over and crying and reading it. And so I didn't even have a real address for him. You know, it just said SPMB Anderson, SP4MB Anderson, you know, 25th Infantry Division, Vietnam. And I wrote a letter. It took like a month to get there. And then he wrote me and I wrote him. And as is the way with letters, you start unfolding yourself in a way. You start revealing stuff that you would probably never reveal in person. And he started talking about the war in ways that he probably would never have told another human being. And I started talking about my life and about demonstrations. At one point, I actually went to jail because of the free speech movement. And so several of the letters I write to him are from jail. And so I'm writing from jail, and he's writing from operations in the field. And it was, you know, the more I looked at this 10 years later, I said, I can't believe that we actually did this.
What did it mean to you at the time to be having an ongoing correspondence with a soldier who was actually in Vietnam?
Well, it made the war different. It made the war human. I mean, I think it would be fair to say that before I wrote to him, before he wrote to me, that if you had asked me what was my position about the war, I would have said that I was pro the National Liberation Front. I was pro the Viet Cong. And I took a very hard line, a very militant position about the war. I mean, that the idea that we should get out never changed. But I certainly didn't see the human aspect of the soldiers. I didn't understand that they were innocent victims, that I didn't understand a whole bunch of stuff about Vietnam that became so clear the minute I started, you know, writing and reading letters from this poetic man, this incredibly intelligent, beautiful man who, you know, was writing from the heart and telling me what was going on in his life. And it changed everything. I think it changed everything for me. Maybe it was responsible for me never being able to be a dogmatist in anything.
Right, because you had to deal with real human beings, not just
Absolutely.
Ideology. Now, what's really interesting to me is that after this long, really personal and philosophical correspondence in which you wrote a lot of personal things and wrote your deepest feelings about the war and politics and felt free to contradict each other when you disagreed, then he was coming back to the States and he was going to meet you. And this kind of idealized long-distance relationship was going to have to contend with, you know, the frictions that people contend with when there are two people in the room together. What did you think was going to happen when you found out that he was, you know, he was going to come see you? What did you expect was going to happen to your relationship?
Well, I was so scared because, remember, I'm still this overweight, you know, person who really hates her body, who, you know, I hated my body, I hated my looks, and he had sent me a snapshot, and I had avoided sending him a snapshot. And I was scared out of my mind. I also was barely not a virgin. I had had sort of two experimental sexual encounters, both of which had been deeply unsatisfying, and in one case, more like a clinical experiment than anything else. And I knew that he had been around. I mean, I knew even from the letters that he had actually had some experiences with sex in Vietnam. And so here I was, you know, madly in love with him, but scared out of my mind what that encounter was going to be like. And in fact, it was difficult. It was difficult because, well, first of all, he was very affected by the war, and he wanted to be inside cars. He wanted to be with his back to the wall. He wanted to sit in front of the TV and flush the toilet and get pizzas, and I wanted to meander around Sausalito or the cafes of Berkeley in the kind of meandering cafe life that I knew and loved. And so that was, you know, we meet, and it was difficult. It was, in one sense, beautiful. I mean, I was still in love with him when I saw him. I thought he was incredible. He was 6'4". I was amazed. And I was very, very attracted to him. But it was very, there was a lot of tension in our meeting.
Did you look at his face when he looked at you for the first time because you were so worried about how he'd react to you physically?
I was scared, but I was, you know, I was like dieting crazy before he came. I was doing all kinds of really crazy things, and we only really had one night. We had two nights together, and then he just had to go, and he went back to Chicago and mucked around and sold encyclopedias and dropped out of school and slowly pulled his life together. But interestingly enough, just one thing was that when he left, for me, the most amazing thing was that I had this dream. And this dream was that I was in Vietnam. And I was standing up to my knees in a rice paddy. And it was incredibly green and hot. And a helicopter suddenly passes overhead and drops a letter. And it's a letter from him, but I'm in Vietnam. And I reach out for the letter, and it drops into the water where these in this rice paddy, and all the letters get blurred, and I wake up. And the first thought out of my mouth as I wake up from that dream is, oh, I get it. I still need his letters. He's out. He's back. He's going back with his life. But I'm sort of in a Vietnam of the soul. I'm still here.
What do you mean by a Vietnam of the soul?
Well, I was still an anti-war activist. I was still involved in all the deep sort of questions about what was right, what was action, how do you save the world? Is action meaningful? Can you change the world? What's the moral right thing to do? All the questions that I write to him in the letters. And he was really interested in picking up his life and going on with things and forgetting, I think, as rapidly as possible, or trying to forget, so much so that 25 years later, he asked for all the letters back because he was going into therapy because he was suddenly, after 25 years, experiencing post-traumatic stress syndrome.
When you finally met the soldier, those 2 days that you spent together, did you have any talks that approximated the depth of feeling that you communicated about the war, about politics, philosophy, your lives, in the letters?
Absolutely not. I would say that all of our talks, even now, are much less emotionally revealing than the letters were.
Now, I feel on some level that I really understand this phenomenon, but I'm going to ask you to see if you can make sense of it, why you could be so intimate and forthcoming in this long-distance letter writing relationship, and why you'd be so comfortable when you actually met. Uncomfortable,
and why it's so easy to do this on the radio, but probably not on television. I think, you know, Tony Schwartz, the ad man, once said that people were born without earlids, and that's why radio is such an intimate medium. And I think letters work like that too. That the stuff of the imagination happens in your head, so you're constantly creating these realities, both in radio and in reading books. You're creating the pictures yourself. And so then suddenly you come across the reality of these pictures. And part of it is that we have images, visual images about the world that come to us through our schooling, from our parents, from all kinds of stuff. And we suddenly see someone, and they represent those images, not what we experience. So Mark, for example, walks in to my world, and suddenly I see the military haircut, the way he carries himself, his sort of reticence, the fact that he doesn't really emote a lot, that he's sort of a Midwestern guy. And all that stuff was not true in the letters. In the letters, he suddenly was able to suddenly explore ways that he probably wasn't able to do in life. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It does. Your book is so much, in a way, about contradictions that you faced during your life and living in different, often conflicting worlds at the same time. And in your book, you say that skepticism and mysticism are sworn enemies, and yet you live simultaneously in the world of skeptics and mystics. You're a journalist, and you have to bring a degree of skepticism to journalism. You can't believe everything at face value. You have to test things and really dig to find what the real truth is, where the real facts are. Yet you're also a mystic. You practice a form of, pagan religion and all kinds of, like, you know, mystic kind of rituals. Do you find it hard to live in both those worlds at the same time?
Well, I don't find it that hard to live in those worlds. I mean, I very often I have this feeling that, you know, I'm supposed to find it hard, and I actually don't find it hard at all. I think the society thinks that mysticism and skepticism are sworn enemies, but I actually think that the two are absolutely united, that you can live in the world of mystery and also believe that a table is a table, you know, that the floor is the floor, that you can dance ecstatically around a bonfire at night and wake up the next morning and be a computer programmer. I think there's a tendency in our culture to paint everything as either or. You know, you're either black or white. You're a man or you're a woman. You're, you know, there's the soul and there's the body. There's materialism or spiritualism. These are all supposed to, these dichotomies are, I think, probably nonsense. And there are a whole bunch of philosophers who've and theorists who've begun to talk about moving away from an either-or kind of culture to a both-and culture.
Of course, a problem you sometimes run into is that the people in one of the worlds you live in don't buy the truth of the other world, and they don't want to allow you to live in both worlds at the same time.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's most people don't want to live in many worlds, and so they say, this is the truth, this is the right, it's either all this, you know? There can't be, you know, it's either either there's no such thing as alien contact, or everybody, you know, is constantly being visited from flying saucers, or you know, you're either an addict or you're an alcoholic. You're an addict, or, you know, an alcoholic, or you have to abstain. You know, all these things. There are all these dichotomies in our life. Where in fact, I think what I might call the shamanic approach is a life of balance, in which you're trying to say, I'm not going to be controlled by any of this, but I'm not going to be overcome by some of this, but I'm going to move, kind of meander through these different worlds and try to lead a reasonably balanced, healthy life while enjoying them all.
Margot Adler, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Margot Adler is NPR's New York bureau chief. Her new memoir about the 60s is called Heretic's Heart.